back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today is a special episode because this is going to be a Mama Minute episode. So if you are kind of new here, I used to do Mama Minute episodes that would really be about anything but true crime, just to kind of balance out the heaviness of constant murder and drama and sadness, because sometimes you just need a minute away from the weight of true crime, a minute from the monotony, a break in tone, a minute to be yourself, take care of yourself, and let your mind go somewhere else. Even if it is just for a minute. For me, I usually do that by watching really bad reality TV like Real Housewives of Salt Lake City or Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, maybe even The Office. But for you guys, I wanted this to be an opportunity to just listen to something else. So we're going to check in on pop culture, talk about whatever chaos the internet has been serving, sharing some motherhood wins, woes, and what the hell moments. We're going to go down a rabbit hole on a Reddit story together, and then we're going to end with one thing from Uncool Cool Moms that's just worth thinking about. And this is going to be the structure of most Mama Minute episodes. So I'd like to make this a regular thing again. I do miss it. And I think it's important for you guys to kind of get to know me as well, aside from, you know, my opinions on true crime. So let's get into it. We're going to kick things off with what the famous people have been up to. Right now, the Justin Baldoni and Blake Lively of it all has reared its ugly head back into the spotlight because new text messages from Taylor Swift have been unredacted and released to the public. So we're going to talk about it. But before we do, since it has been over a year, let's do a quick recap. So filming for It Ends With Us began back in 2023, and the film was directed, as we all know, by Justin Baldoni through his company, Wayfarer Studios, and of course it starred Blake Lively. The movie was released on August 9th of 2024. So as the press tour rolled out, people quickly noticed that something felt off. Blake and Justin were never seen together during promotions for the film. They did separate interviews, separate appearances, and more noticeably, they promoted the movie in very different ways. Blake leaned into a lighter, almost rom-com style framing of the film while also cross-promoting her hair and her liquor brands. And you might remember the famous clip of her saying, "Grab your friends, grab your florals, and head out to see it," as if it's like a rom-com. And, you know, the movie is about domestic violence. So Justin, on the other hand, promoted the movie as a serious story centered on domestic violence, which aligned more closely with the original book's message. You would know that if you read the book. So the disconnect was really obvious and uncomfortable, especially given the subject matter. Not long after, rumors started circulating that Blake felt sidelined during the promotional process and that there had been some tension on set. Those rumors escalated significantly when the New York Times published an article titled, quote, "We can bury anyone inside a Hollywood smear machine," end quote. That same day that article dropped, Blake's complaint to the California Civil Rights Department was publicly released. So both the article and the complaint outlined allegations that Blake made against Justin. She claimed that he created a hostile work environment, citing inappropriate comments about her appearance, unprofessional behavior, and allegations that he had improvised physical intimacy before an intimacy coordinator had been arranged. The complaint further alleged that after she had raised concerns, Justin and others at Wayfarer Studios engaged in a retaliatory campaign that was intended to damage her reputation, including efforts to influence media coverage and shift public perception, which is honestly so ironic considering what Blake has done since the movie premiered. The article also highlighted allegations that Justin's team used crisis PR firms and narrative management tactics to counter Blake's claims. And as a result, public opinion began to shift. Instead of focusing on whether Blake had promoted a domestic violence story inappropriately, the conversation moved toward the possibility that she herself had been mistreated. And if you want like a deeper dive on this, I've got some episodes from last year that you can check out where I really go, went pretty deep in the court transcripts, the released files, the discovery. I went through all of it. But Justin Baldoni has publicly and forcefully denied these allegations. He later actually sued the New York Times for libel and false light, arguing that the article relied too heavily on Blake's narrative and lacked sufficient evidence. And a judge ultimately dismissed that lawsuit because of the right to free speech, free press. They had reached out to Justin for a comment, despite the fact that they reached out to him only 12 hours before the article actually dropped. Like, I don't know what they would have really expected. I think they did that on purpose, knowing that to give him such a short time frame to respond, he would either not comment at all or not have time to generate an appropriate response. But I think that probably just kind of saved their asses. You know, they just checked the box like, well, we gave him an opportunity to comment despite it being hours, less than a day before the actual article dropped. So the following month, Justin filed a countersuit against Blake and her husband, Ryan Reynolds, alleging defamation, extortion, and civil conspiracy. Along with that countersuit, Justin Baldoni and his legal team released a large volume of emails, texts, and internal communications attempting to show that there was no smear campaign that ever existed and that Blake's negative press was basically her own fault. At that point, the narrative began to shift again toward the idea that Blake may have not been telling the full story. And a lot of people were actually comparing her to Amber Heard in these moments, you know, that she was like this girl that was crying abuse because she didn't get her way, when in reality, maybe abuse didn't actually happen. That's how people were parallel, comparing the two cases. So after multiple rounds of legal filings, a federal judge dismissed Justin's countersuit in the summer of 2025. He was given the opportunity to amend the lawsuit, but just never refiled it. Blake did not drop her case, though, and the matter continued toward trial. The trial was initially scheduled for March of 2026, and it has now been postponed to May 18th of this year. Then earlier this month, newly unsealed court documents revealed extensive text messages between Blake and Taylor Swift, which of course pulls Taylor directly into this controversy. We knew that this was a possibility, but we just didn't know how far it went. We knew that Taylor was brought to the penthouse to discuss the scene that Blake had rewritten. That was all in the files because Justin had talked about it, but we never actually saw anything that was quoted directly from Taylor Swift. We didn't see any emails or text messages that actually were from her until now. So Blake and Taylor had been close friends for years and frequently appeared together publicly. Taylor entered the legal narrative because Justin alleged in his countersuit that she was present during some key interactions and basically pressured him creatively. According to Justin's claims, Taylor was at Blake and Ryan's New York penthouse during a meeting where Blake presented some script rewrites. Apparently, this was all surrounding the famous rooftop scene where Justin and Blake's characters first meet each other. And Blake had rewritten this scene because she felt like she could make it funnier and punchier, I guess. So anyway, he alleged that Taylor enthusiastically praised Blake's version of the script, which made him feel pressured to accept those changes, especially given Taylor's cultural influence and the fact that her music was also featured in the film. So following that meeting, Justin texted Blake that her changes were so much more fun and interesting and that he would have felt that way without Ryan and Taylor. He said that in the message. And Blake responded by calling Ryan and Taylor her dragons, a Khaleesi reference from, is it Game of Thrones, I believe? And she later referred to them as her dance mom level stage moms. Now, at this time, the information was already known in pretty broad strokes, but the newly unsealed texts added some significant detail that really, really put Taylor in the mess of it all. So on April 12th of 2023, Blake texted Taylor while Taylor was on her way to the penthouse. Blake asked Taylor to endorse her revised script to Justin. The text actually reads verbatim, quote, "If you get here with this doofus director of my movie is still here, I'll be ushering him out, but hope he's still here. Can you do me a huge favor? I need help with him. Can you tell him you're excited for the movie, that you read the book, but what you're freaking out over is the pages I sent you. What a magnetic scene that is, or whatever descriptives you're comfortable with. I'll send you the scene. You don't have to read it, of course. It's a quick read. He's a clown and thinks he's a writer now and got this rewrite and told me he appreciates my passion. That's it. So having the greatest living storyteller unknowingly echo to him how much you love what we're doing, giving him credit as if he wrote them with me, will go such a long way. You dug a movie out of a grave once already for me." End quote. Taylor replied, "I'll do anything for you," with 2 exclamation points. End quote. So after the meeting, Blake followed up saying, quote, "You were so epically heroic today. I recapped every moment to Ryan. I kept remembering stuff, you making shit up about me and lenses and referring to yourself as my doll, this clown falling for all of it, but also resisting it. You are the world's absolute greatest friend ever. I won the lottery." End quote. Taylor responded in all caps, quote, "I won the lottery. You are the coolest person in the world. And you like me!" ! End quote. Then Blake sent a long follow-up message basically criticizing Justin and praising Taylor's influence, reacting strongly to a comment that he allegedly made about not really knowing pop culture and expressing how protective she feels of Taylor. So just for a note of context, this period between April of 2023 and through May of 2024 is marked by mounting creative conflict, competing edits of the film, and obviously some escalating behind-the-scenes tension. But the reason that these text messages from Taylor are so important is because she has before, whether it was through spokespeople or whatever, has said that she had absolutely nothing to do with this film. She had nothing to do with the creative process of this film. But obviously, Taylor Swift knows who she is. She knows how big of a star she is, what kind of power she yields. She knows that. So to show up and say, "Oh, I'll do anything for you, Blake," and then make shit up without having read the pages or even the book, allegedly, I mean, it's not been confirmed whether she read the book before or after this meeting even took place. We do know that Blake never read the book, which is obviously a big problem. But it just seems like these girls are acting like mean girls and that they're basically teaming up to get their way against Justin Baldoni, who is obviously not as famous and not as powerful as these women are. But let's also not forget, Justin Baldoni is the director. Justin Baldoni was the writer for the movie. Colleen Hoover wrote the book, but she sold the rights to the book to Justin Baldoni's production team, Wayfarer Studios and Sony. So at that point, you know, it's up to Justin Baldoni ultimately. The director has the final say in whatever the movie is going to end up being. I think for Blake, that was a huge issue for her because she's, you know, she was controlling and wanted a lot of say over the film. She obviously wanted say on the wardrobe, on the scenes, on the edits. And we saw that in the deep dives that I did last year. So fast forward to May 17th of 2024, Blake emailed Ben Affleck describing the production as, quote, "the most upsetting experience of her career," accusing Justin of being incompetent, having ego issues, having an involved with a cult because he's into Baha'i, which is like a religious group, I guess, or a faith, and claiming that she rewrote and effectively directed the movie herself. She asked Ben Affleck to watch her cut ahead of an upcoming bake-off between her edit and Justin's. That same day, she contacted Matt Damon and his wife and with some similar requests and messaging, again describing the production as chaotic and traumatic. And then 2 days later, on May 19th, Blake texted Taylor alleging that author Colleen Hoover had contacted her claiming that Justin was running an internal smear campaign to get his edit approved. Blake wrote that Colleen had flown to New York, supported Blake's cut, and that Bradley Cooper, Matt Damon, and others backed her version. So to add context to this, my understanding of what happened here is that Blake was given the right to like produce her own edit, basically, that she was allowed in the editing room and, you know, created this edit. And then they sent the edit to be tested in front of a group of people, like a focus group. And they were going to compare the scores of Blake's edit with Justin's edit. And in reality, Blake's edit did not score as well as Justin's in a lot of the categories, which I talked about in that past deep dive. But she seems to be trying, again, to use her power and her connections to people like Ben Affleck and Matt Damon and Taylor Swift to get her way, despite the fact that her cut is just simply not as good. It's like she just won't take no for an answer. And obviously, Taylor senses this because after that May 19th text, Taylor replied, No one, period, should ever, period, get into a war of wills with you, end quote. So by December of 2024, Blake appeared to sense some distance in her friendship with Taylor. She sent a vulnerable message asking basically if everything was okay, acknowledging that she had been consumed by the whole Justin situation and worried if she had become, you know, a bad friend. And Taylor responded honestly, saying that she felt exhausted and that Blake's recent messages kind of felt impersonal, like a mass corporate email, and that she just missed Blake's normal voice. It seemed like in their back and forth, they really like quickly squashed it and worked it out. But despite that, there was one exchange that stood out to me, which was when Taylor sent Blake a screenshot of a People magazine Instagram post that was featuring Justin Baldoni with the caption about his past sexual trauma, adding, quote, "I think this bitch knows something is coming because he's gotten out his tiny violin," end quote. And then in another text saying, "This is so disgusting and I hate that he's clever about this shit," end quote. So she is basically saying that he's coming out with this past sexual trauma as a ploy to get people to feel bad for him or have sympathy for him. The fact that Taylor Swift had the audacity to say that, and granted, this is in a private text with her friend, she never thought that anyone was ever going to see this, but are we making fun of and mocking victims of sexual assault now? Isn't that kind of the crux of Blake's whole case? And also Taylor Swift, if anyone would know about, you know, your artwork getting stolen, wouldn't it be you? I mean, Justin is really trying to defend this masterpiece that he has built. Like, he wrote this, he directed it, it's his baby. And then Blake is coming in kind of acting like a Scooter Braun, trying to take it over, trying to own it essentially and steal it from him. The fact that Taylor doesn't see that correlation is kind of mind-blowing to me, but also it's probably just because she's got blinders on for her best friend. So anyway, since all of these texts have come out, there has been no comment on the situation from Blake's team or Taylor's team, but I think it's worth noting that after a lot of this stuff started coming up last year, Travis unfollowed Ryan Reynolds on Instagram. Taylor Swift does not follow anybody on Instagram, so who's to know if she, you know, is still good friends with Blake. You know, people are saying that her song Canceled is written in support of Blake, which is just kind of confusing to me because apparently it's like a hit piece on Justin Baldoni, but the lyrics just don't really make sense, I guess, if that's the case. I don't know. That's just what I've been seeing people say online. And then, of course, Blake still follows Taylor. So who knows what the dynamic is now. It used to be that in some of the messages that Blake was sending to Taylor, she was also including Travis. And she would be like, "Show Trav my cut too and see what he thinks. I want to hear his thoughts also." And it seemed like they all were kind of this group of friends. But for Travis to unfollow Ryan on Instagram, which is obviously like a pretty public move, like you know that that's going to get some people's attention, it seems pretty telling. And now people are in Travis's comment section basically telling him Taylor is a mean girl, telling him to run while he still can. I don't know. I want to know your thoughts on this. If you're listening on Spotify, leave a comment on this episode, or you can go to my Instagram and leave a comment there. But the whole story just seems kind of chaotic, and I guess we'll see where it goes from here, because this story is far from over. Now, speaking of chaos, let's talk about what's been blowing up online. It is time for Chronically Online, what has been dominating the algorithm. Right now, I don't know about you, but Fernando Mendoza has been dominating my feed, and I am here for it. I love this kid. He is a kid in my eyes. I think he's probably only 18 or 19. Or actually, no, he's got to be older than that. He's probably like 20 or 21. He's a college athlete. Okay, anyway, Fernando Mendoza just led the Indiana Hoosiers football team to their first ever college football playoff national championship, finishing undefeated for the entire season and beating the Miami Hurricanes 27-21 in a wild, iconic game. He not only threw for big numbers and ran the go-ahead score, but he captured hearts doing it. He led the team with a 16-0 undefeated season, which is unheard of for Indiana football. And get this, Indiana football was so far under the radar that Adidas, who makes their jerseys, actually spelled Indiana wrong on one of their jerseys back in 2021. It said Indinia, like I-N-D-I-N-I-A. But that is just how like under the radar this team was for a long time. Nobody was paying attention to Hoosier football, except maybe Hoosiers. But Fernando came in and changed all of that. So a little backstory on Fernando. He was born in Boston, but raised in Miami, Florida, where he played high school football at Christopher Columbus High. He was a talented quarterback, but not a blue chip recruit, more of a grinding, steady leader. He started his college career at Cal, which is University of California, Berkeley, where he played multiple seasons and finished his business degree before transferring. In 2025, he landed at Indiana, joining his younger brother, Alberto, and immediately became the catalyst for a massive turnaround. Now, what seems to have made Mendoza such a viral favorite beyond just his stats and winning is this person that he seems to be. So after the championship, one of the most talked about viral moments wasn't a highlight reel. It was him tearfully embracing his mom on the field, surrounded by family, celebrating one of the biggest wins in this program's history. Now, he is very, very close with his family. Fernando's mom, Elsa Mendoza, has been a central figure in his life, far beyond just being the QB's mom. She was actually diagnosed with multiple sclerosis nearly two decades ago and is now confined to a wheelchair. So watching her on the sideline at these big games, especially during Indiana's championship run, has become one of the most moving parts of this story. His dad, Fernando Mendoza Sr., is a pediatric emergency physician who is based in Miami, and he was actually a competitive rower back in college and even won a gold medal at the Junior World Championships before studying biology at Brown University. And it's really sweet to watch his parents watching these games, because every time there's a big play, Fernando is like still down at his wife's side because she's obviously in this wheelchair. And so he's like celebrating with her, and it looks like he's sitting, but he's really just enjoying the moment with her. It's very sweet and endearing to watch. His younger brother, Alberto, was his backup quarterback at Indiana. They are super tight. And his younger brother, Max, is not a football player, but I think he's still in high school and has been a very vocal supporter, often seen with the family watching the games and cheering them on. I think the little brother, Max, actually is wanting to become a sports broadcaster, so still heavily in the world of sports. Interviews after games and in the draft process highlight how he talks about his family's influence, his gratitude, and his belief in something bigger than himself. Not ego, not self-serving quotes, just like a grounded, you know, grounded deep foundation in faith. And that's why so many people on social media feel genuinely connected to him, because he just seems so good. He has this like golden retriever energy about him. Here is a clip from a couple of his interviews. I'm just going to play a few so you can get a sound of what he's like. This first clip is actually his speech after he won the Heisman Trophy this year.
Mommy, this is your trophy as much as it is mine. You've always been my biggest fan. You're my light. You're my why. You're my biggest supporter. Your sacrifices, courage, love, those have been my first playbook and the playbook that I'm going to carry through my side through my entire life. You taught me that toughness doesn't need to be loud. It can be quiet and strong. It's choosing hope. It's believing in yourself when the world doesn't give you much reason to. Together, you and I are rewriting what people think is possible. I love you.
So that was right after he won the Heisman Trophy. And then he also addresses his parents because he is from a Cuban family. So when he says mommy at the beginning, I think he's saying mommy like M-A-M-I, which is, you know, typical Cuban culture. But here is him addressing his grandparents in that same speech.
And for my grandparents, por el amor y sacrificio de mis padres y abuelos, lo quiero mucho. De todo mi corazón, de todas las gracias.
Now, this last clip I'm going to play for you is right after he won right after they beat Ohio State. I think this is the game they won to actually go to the national championship. But this is his interview, and it is just so sweet. You just have to listen.
The Big Ten champs. How does that sound?
It sounds so beautiful. I want to give all the glory to God. We were never supposed to be in this position, but by the glory of God, the great coaches, great teammates, and we have around us, we were able to pull this off. Whoever thought the Hoosiers would be here, but now the Hoosiers are flipping champs. Let's go!
Now, the icing on the cake of all of this is that when he was attempting to play college football, he actually tried to walk on the Miami Hurricanes team as like a two-star recruit or something. I don't really know football terms or lingo or anything like that, but he tried to join the Miami Hurricanes football team and they basically said no. So he went and played elsewhere and then ended up beating the Miami Hurricanes in the national championship. So it's very much like a pretty woman moment, like, oh, you wouldn't handle me before? Big mistake. You work on commission, right? Big mistake. Big, huge. I have to go win a Heisman now. So anyway, I freaking love him. Mendoza has officially declared for the 2026 NFL draft, and it's been projected that he will be the number one pick for the Las Vegas Raiders. They have first dibs, and they are projected to take him. Even NFL legends like Tom Brady have publicly praised his maturity and his future potential. So this is probably just the beginning for Fernando Mendoza, and I am here for it.
Getting dressed should not be that hard. And yet somehow, whenever I'm like trying to dress up to go on a date or do something fun with Austin, I'm usually standing in front of a full closet thinking, I have nothing to wear. And that is why I love Armoire. Armoire makes getting dressed easy with a clothing rental membership that builds a wardrobe just for you with high quality, unique brands that actually make sense for your life. You take a quick 5-minute style quiz, pick items from your personalized closet, and they show up at your door in as little as 2 days. When you're ready for something new, you just swap them out and that's it. I've been using Armoire because my body, my lifestyle, and just my personal style have all changed, and buying new clothes every time just isn't feeling realistic. One of my favorite pieces I've rented was actually this white and blue dress that Austin and I went to a Teddy Swims concert. I wore the dress. I actually posted a video of us dancing at the concert and it went kind of viral. And I had so many people asking me where I got this dress, and I rented it from Armoire. And I'll also be honest, I've always felt guilty about how many things in my closet I've only worn once, if at all. Some things still have a tag on them, but Armoire completely changed that for me. I get to stay on trend, wear beautiful designer pieces, and then there's also like loungewear that I love too. I had this really beautiful floral Kate Spade wind jacket, like wind blazer. It was so cute. I wore it on vacation, got lots of compliments, and then when I didn't feel like wearing it anymore, you just send it back. It's so easy. Another huge bonus, Armoire is women-founded and women-led. They even spotlight women-owned designers, which makes me feel good about where my money is going. So if you're struggling to define your style right now, or maybe your body is changing because of fitness or pregnancy or just life, Armoire is such a good solution. You can size up, size down, try new silhouettes, and swap whenever you need to. There's no commitment, no pressure, just clothes that fit you where you are. And somehow it's all designer without the designer price tag. Instead of spending hundreds on one dress that I might wear one time, I kind of get this rotating closet of high-end pieces for a fraction of the cost. Fashion math finally makes sense. It's not girl math, it's fashion math. One feature I have to mention is quarterly rentals, because Armoire is the only rental company that lets you keep favorite pieces for an entire season for just $10 a month. So if you find something you truly love, you don't have to give it back right away. And if you decide to keep it, then that fee ends up going towards the final purchase. You get to decide what stays for a month, a season, or forever. And right now, my listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 60% off their first month. That's up to $150 off. Just visit armoire.style/mama. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/mama, MAMA, to get up to 60% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today and thank me tomorrow. Every January, I tell myself the same thing. This is the year I'm going to feel better, more energy, clearer focus, just less dragging myself through every day. And I'll be honest, I usually start the year doing everything right, or at least I think I am. Like, I'm sleeping, I'm eating better, I'm moving my body, and somehow I still feel exhausted and foggy and irritable over things that normally should not get to me, like even just my kids being kids. Well, for a long time, I just assumed that that was stress or burnout or just life in general. And what I didn't realize is that low iron can show up really quietly. Things like persistent fatigue, brain fog, headaches that don't go fully away, brittle nails, hair breakage, stuff that's easy to brush off or normalize. These are all symptoms that I was dealing with because I was suffering from low iron. And here's the thing, iron deficiency can exist even before anemia actually develops. So you can feel off long before anything looks serious or shows up like on a blood panel. So that is why I started looking into Siderol from PharmaNutra. Siderol is a premium iron supplement powered by patented sucrosomial technology. So basically the iron is protected so your body can absorb it more efficiently, about 3 to 4 times better than standard iron. And without the common stomach issues that people associate with iron supplements like nausea or constipation. It's made with just two main ingredients. There's 30 milligrams of sucrosomial iron and vitamin C, and it's a simple once a day capsule that you can take anytime with or without food. So what stood out to me is that it's backed by over 20 years of research and more than 150 clinical studies, and it's already trusted by over 2 million people worldwide. So if you're starting the year feeling kind of tired or foggy despite having these otherwise good habits, you're not alone, and this might be the support that your body needs. So do yourself a favor and head to PharmaNutra-US.com and use the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, for 10% off your first order of Siderol. That's PharmaNutra-US.com with the promo code MAMA. Feeling off doesn't always mean something's wrong. Sometimes it just means something is missing. So check it out today.
All right, now let's come back down to earth for a minute. It is time for Motherhood Wins, Woes, and What the Hell. So this segment, I actually have a special guest, yours truly,
Austin.
Austin is here. It's been a minute since I've had Austin on an episode with me, at least a deep dive, because the deep dives, it's a lot harder to get him, you know, to sit down with me for like over an hour. He's just a busy guy. But at least for this segment, you get a little taste of Austin. Oh, that sounded interesting.
A little taste of me.
Yeah, that's not, the taste is only for me. Okay, anyway, so listen, I wanted to bring him on for this segment because we had a really eventful weekend. So much of the country got blasted with a ton of snow. And so did we. I mean, we got a pretty decent amount of snow. We didn't get much ice, thank God, because that can be pretty devastating. But we did get a bunch of snow. And Austin had an idea to build an igloo. Take it away, Austin.
So I saw all these people building igloos online, and I never built an igloo as a kid. You know, I've built cool snowmen. I mean, me and Jack and Kennedy, when we were years ago, we built an awesome 6-foot-tall, 7-foot-tall snowman, but never an igloo. So on Instagram, you know, you see things and it inspires you. I see these people building these crazy, complex, beautiful igloos with like blue, green, red, yellow blocks, and they're amazing. So I was like, way too late. I should have thought of it before the cold hit, but whatever. So was it Sunday morning? Yeah, Sunday morning, I went to Sam's Club and I bought 4 36-packs, so 144 half-size foil pans, and came home, filled them all up with water, which took forever. You have to lay them all out, which, some tips, okay? Lay them out flat. Don't lay them in the snow and think, oh, the snow is going to help, because then you get one side of the block that's real thick, one side that's real thin. So had to lay them all out flat, which I had to redo, fill them all up with a bucket of water, which was one bucket of water. I'd go to the spigot and fill it up, and I could fill up like 5. So you can do the math. I went to the spigot like, you know, 40 times almost.
But if you, and I thought if you attach a hose, then you might risk the hose, like any water getting left in the hose, expanding and busting
the
hose.
Yeah, you definitely
could. I know some people might be thinking like, just use a hose, but that might not actually be the best.
Maybe you could if you just didn't leave it connected after. But anyways, finally get them all full, and then they have to freeze, okay? Which, even though it was like negative 15, it still takes hours to freeze. The top would freeze and they wouldn't be frozen. So I left them overnight. So in that short period following filling them up, I went and got a huge tote and I started filling it up with snow, dumping buckets of water in with it, and then snow, bucket of water, snow, bucket of water. And I built this like real thick foundation base. And I have, I mean, the thing is probably, what, 8-foot circle?
Oh, for sure. And if you're following this on Instagram, then you've seen all of it because we've been documenting the process a lot on my Instagram page.
So on Sunday, no one was really interested in building it with me, but they all thought it was cool. The kids did. The kids thought it was cool.
I was
cool.
Like, can you please come in here and hang out with us? Because I'm all alone with three kids or four kids and you're outside building an igloo.
Like every 30 minutes though, Jack would come down to the window and he'd knock and he'd get so excited and be like, it's looking good, with thumbs up. And that was always fun. And then Augie would come to the window. Kennedy wasn't that interested, but, and then later, so I go inside, Kelly's kind of over it. And at one point Augie was like, Daddy, how come you aren't playing outside? Which was so funny.
Yes, I was making dinner and he comes in the kitchen and Augie's like, why aren't you playing outside anymore? And Austin looks at him and he goes, because I'm not allowed to.
Because mommy made me come inside. And Augie keeps calling an igloo, which is hilarious. He keeps saying, Daddy, how's the igloo? Are you working on my igloo? And I love it. He calls it an igloo.
But you have really like figured out the tricks. Like, so the first day you had offered me to come outside. I come outside. I'm just standing there. I'm like, I am useless here. You're, you know, dumping these big totes of snow to build your base. But I didn't know. I couldn't see any need for me. So I was like, screw this. I'm going back inside. It's too freaking cold. And the next day, once you started actually placing the blocks, I had just laid Ellie down for a nap. And I'm looking outside, kind of watching the progress, and I see you struggling to hold up the two blocks. And I'm like, okay, this is where I could see myself being useful.
So you take the blocks, you have to make this mortar, right? Like building a brick house. So you take a bucket, you fill it up with water. And I learned that needs to be like pretty watery. At first I was putting like mostly snow. It needs to be mostly water. You're literally putting your hands, your gloves into a bucket of water with a little bit of snow. And you would put the block in place and then go around the seal of the block to seal it in with your snow mortar, your ice mortar, right? So I'm struggling. And let me just say, like, without making it too inspirational and nerdy, building an igloo by yourself, first of all, I don't recommend building an igloo by yourself. Mm-hmm. Get help. Second, it's very much like anything in life worth a shit. Like, you know, building a business, it's like a lonely road and it sucks and you want to quit, but you keep going because you see the kids smiling. In business, you keep going because you're making progress. And eventually everybody thinks it's cool and comes outside and joins you. Once you get far enough along, it's like the congratulations is sweet, right? So I'm doing these blocks and I'm struggling and these hands appeared on the blocks and Jack was outside, but he wasn't helping with that part. He was laying on the ground. And
He was laying on the ground staring at the sky.
These hands appeared on the blocks and I'm so into it. I said, be careful. And I thought it was Jack. And I'm like, be careful holding it. And I look up and it's Kelly. And I was like, oh my God, you're here. You're here to help me.
He was so happy.
Yes. I mean, over the moon happy. We start cooking through it. And lo and behold, just like I thought, once Kelly saw the vision, she was so into it that we paused because Ellie woke up from her nap. We go inside and Kelly was sitting on the stairs looking at it. And I was like, you want to go work on it, don't you? And she was like, yeah, kind of. And then Kelly ends up out there by herself working on the igloo. Full circle.
We made some great progress yesterday. So when you and I were working together, I mean, once you set a block, it's actually pretty satisfying and fascinating how once you set the block there and then you put the mortar in the cracks and you kind of hold it there for a minute, all it takes is like 60 seconds and it's frozen. I mean, I started putting the cover to like the entrance to the igloo. And so it's basically like this freestanding block, basically. And so I'm holding it there and I'm like, I'm afraid to let go because if it falls, I'm going to be devastated. But it's still there. It's still hanging on. It's basically just this like ledge that's kind of sticking out, but it froze pretty quickly.
Held by nothing. It's just off the side of the block.
Yeah. And you know, you see these things on Instagram or Pinterest or whatever, and it's like, oh, that looks kind of crazy. But it's actually a lot easier than you think. I mean, yes, it's hard work.
I don't know if I'd say that at all.
No, I mean, it's hard work. But like, once you get the gist of it, it's like anybody could do this.
Yeah, it makes sense. The ones on Instagram, though, I don't get it. They're beautiful. Everything's perfect. They look AI generated.
Well, they have like colored blocks too. They put like food coloring in their blocks.
Yeah.
And, you know, next year, maybe we'll do that.
Maybe. I'm not committing anything. He's like, I'm not doing I need help from the start next year.
But it is really freaking cool. Yesterday we started, you know, kind of closing the dome part. And so the blocks were at a pretty steep incline of like 45 degrees. And I was getting nervous thinking some were going to fall. But they didn't. And it's really coming together. This thing is going to last us a couple weeks, I think.
Every level you go up, you have to start tilting it in, and you have to start tilting it in kind of aggressively, or you're going to end up with a 20-foot tall igloo.
Mm-hmm. And with a silo in your front yard.
Yeah. So right now this thing is like probably 5 feet tall, angling in. We have a good opening at the top still. I don't know if we have enough blocks to finish it. I don't even know if I have enough gumption to finish it. It might be on Kelly, but it's been a lot of fun. And this morning when we left, Augie, we were leaving for school, and Augie went inside it and said, I want to see my igloo. And he's so excited, and Jack and Ken think it's cool. And
it is pretty cool.
It's awesome.
I think it'll last a while too, since it's basically just a block of ice. Yeah. I mean, that thing's going to take a minute.
And it's in a shaded part. So build an igloo with your family. Yeah. It's fun.
Highly recommend.
10 out of 10.
Thank you for sitting with me on this segment. Is there anything else you want to add before you go?
Thanks for helping.
Yeah, you're welcome. I hope you'll join me again next week for Parenthood, Wins, Woes, and What the Hell.
Heck yeah, I'm out.
All right, see you later, babe. Thank you.
Love you.
Love you. All right, transitioning into other people's drama again, it is time for the Reddit rabbit hole. Now, I discovered Reddit just a few years ago. I am kind of new to this still, I feel, but I just usually like reading the Am I the Asshole stories while I'm trying to fall asleep. And sometimes I come across a good one, and so I'm going to share with you. If you ever come across a good one, or if you just have a story you want to share yourself that you would like to have read aloud, even if you want it to be anonymous and you just want to vent, please send them my way. You can reach me on mamamystery.com. You just scroll down to that white box and you can send me a message. If you want me to know who you are, you're going to have to put it in the message. But if you want to just stay anonymous, then just keep it so. All right. This story is titled, Am I the Asshole for Not Getting My Nephew an Internship Interview After Getting Them for Most of the Others? So this person writes, I work for a large organization that brings on interns, and over the years I've gotten most of, but not all, my nieces and nephews interviews. They are never guaranteed spots. All I do is get them in an interview pile. My nephew is graduating, and his mom, my sister-in-law, asked me about the internship, and I told her that Eric needs to be the one to reach out to me. When he finally came to me, it was obvious he was just doing it because she told him to. He did not seem interested, and if I'm honest, the way he speaks is childish. It's all brain-dead, bruh, fam, TikTok speak. He could not articulate, neither can I, why he wanted the internship. I told him that if he really wants this, I need him to show me, and I asked him to write me a brief note giving me the reasons he wanted the internship and what he planned on doing with the experience. I was surprised he sent me anything at all, but when I read it, it was obviously AI generated. I told him I could not put in a good word for him because he could not even do the bare minimum. He had a complete meltdown over it, telling me that I was being unfair and that no one these days actually writes stuff like this. His mom came at me too, saying the same things. I told them both, I'm not going to risk my own reputation. I asked him point blank, why do you want this internship? And he responded, I don't know. My brother made the case that my nephew had struggled during the pandemic. The academic landscape has changed, and he needs someone to give him a chance to show him what he can do. And that years ago, someone had given me a chance despite not being a straight A student, which is true. Part of me thinks I should get him an interview just so he can see how unprepared he is, but I know that would be a mean thing to do. Am I wrong to not get him an interview? Is this just how kids are these days? So my first thoughts are that, you know, this is not an issue about favoritism. It's about effort and professionalism. You obviously did not deny your nephew an internship. You didn't block him from applying, but by refusing to put your name and reputation behind someone who couldn't even articulate why they wanted the opportunity is a pretty reasonable boundary, in my opinion. Obviously, you're not asking for anything extreme by asking him to just reach out himself. I mean, these kids these days, I laugh, but it's actually scary. So many kids these days, and by kids, I mean like teenagers, they don't look at you in the eye when they speak to you. I've had instances myself where I just go to American Eagle, for example. I went to American Eagle in Dallas at like this big mall that they have there. And the girl that was checking me out did not say one word to me, did not acknowledge me, didn't even look at me. And so finally I was like, hi, And she just looked up at me as if like, how dare I be talking to her? And I was like, how are you? And she just looked at me again and was like, good. And that was it. So, I mean, a lot of these kids don't know how to exist in the real professional world in today's landscape. And maybe you can call it, you know, the pandemic when we were all sheltered in place and not allowed to go to school. We were all doing virtual learning. I can absolutely see how that would be a detriment to, you know, kids' social skills and the development of their social skills. But that's where you as a parent have to step in and make sure that they are getting that supplemental education by making sure they know how to greet somebody, practice shaking hands, practice finishing a sentence, finishing an answer even. That is your responsibility as a parent. The teachers at school are not supposed to teach your kids absolutely everything. There's stuff that you have to do as a parent too. So that's kind of where I stand as it relates to that. But on the flip side, you know, playing devil's advocate, this can absolutely be read as moving the goalposts or making him, you know, holding him to a higher standard than the others. You know, she's admitted that she helped most of the nieces and nephews get interviews, which creates an expectation, whether it's fair or not, that this is something that you're doing for your family. And suddenly with him, there seems to be this extra hurdle. However, you know, even as I play devil's advocate, I'm like, well, did the other nieces and nephews do the work to reach out to her and, you know, fill out the application and write something that wasn't AI generated? Because if that's the case, then no, he's just creating his own hurdles. So anyway, that's kind of where I stand. I feel like the root of the issue here is this generational expectation. Much of today's youth is woefully underprepared, if not just completely unprepared for the world, because they're either, you know, maybe the pandemic had its detriments, but I think they're also so consumed with their own phones, their social media profiles. And so they're not really interacting with people face to face. They're only interacting with people through phones. And it's scary, but it's also not totally surprising. So what would I do in this situation? If I'm being honest, I think I would probably put his name in for an interview for a few reasons. One, to keep the peace with my siblings. I wouldn't want to, you know, have this be something that ruins Thanksgiving and Christmas from here on out, but also too in hopes that if he does fumble the interview, that maybe it's a humbling wake-up call. But on that note, I think it is the perfect segue into our last topic. So before we go, I want to share one thing from Uncool Cool Moms that is worth thinking about. So if you don't already know about the Uncool Cool Moms Club, it is a club where we as parents commit to keeping our kids off of social media until they are at least 15 years old. My goal here is to share information about the dangers of kids having their own social media profiles on social media like Snapchat, Facebook, TikTok, Pinterest even, and you know, getting carried away with doom scrolling. Now, here is the fact. An estimated 93% of U.S. teens ages 13 to 17 use social media with an average of about 4 hours a day spent on these platforms. Research shows that teens who spend more time on social media report higher rates of anxiety and depression, with about 32% of adolescents reporting anxiety and 13% reporting depression in one study. Figures some researchers link to social media exposure. Now, obviously, correlation does not always equal causation, but I think common sense would tell you that it's probably a detriment to your mental health if you're spending 4 hours a day on these platforms. And when you think about it, if you're spending 4 hours a day and you have 8 or 9 hours at school, that's basically all your time at home when you could be interacting with family or friends or whatever, you're on your phone. And so it just doesn't leave a lot of room for like those important family moments and those family discussions. The World Health Organization estimates that about 1 in 10 adolescents show signs of problematic social media use, where screen time starts interfering with real life. Nearly half of U.S. teens say that they are online constantly, with platforms like YouTube, TikTok, and Snapchat deeply woven into their daily life. Studies looking at adolescents and young people have found that higher frequency social media use is associated with more distraction and difficulties with sustained attention, particularly when multitasking or using multiple platforms. And another report found about 68% of young respondents said that social media harms harms their ability to focus, especially with short form video content, just reshaping how attention works. And you can see this with TikTok, and also YouTube. YouTube Shorts is essentially TikTok, but it's all these short form videos where you're really trying to grab the viewer's attention in the first 5 seconds. And if you can maintain it for that long, you know, depending on what kind of content they're consuming, sometimes it gets into this like doomsday scrolling. And I've talked about this in the past, but your algorithm is shaped based on what you are interested in. So if you show even a little bit of interest or relatability towards something that is kind of sad or maybe hints at depression, then your algorithm is going to start feeding you more of that. And so we see these spikes in mental health issues, depression, suicidal ideation, and suicide attempts, if not suicide completion. And I have to just wonder if part of that is because of our activity on social media, not only doom scrolling, but also getting online on Snapchat and bullying each other. You know, my kids are in fifth and sixth grade, and they recently sent a letter home from their school saying that there's been an issue with Snapchat. My kids do not have Snapchat. They don't have Instagram. They don't have TikTok. They might be in some of my posts on social media, but that is as far as their like interaction really goes with it. They don't have a phone that is their own. Or anything like that. But they recently sent home this letter regarding Snapchat and how a bunch of their classmates were getting on there to, one, create these group Snapchats where they were all talking shit on each other. And like, if one person wasn't in the group, then the group would basically go on a tangent on this one person that wasn't in it. And then surely that person's going to find out, because fifth and sixth graders, they will tell whoever the victim is, they will tell the victim that like, hey, so-and-so said this about you in a group chat. Like, they're not shy about letting people know this. But not only that, these fifth and sixth graders are asking each other for nude photos. Nude photos, you guys, like fifth and sixth grade, we're talking 10 to 11 and 12 year olds. This is absolutely absurd. So if you have a kid and they have their own phone, you have to be responsible and monitor what they are doing on that phone. There has to be screen limits. There has to be monitoring on what exactly they're doing on these phones, who they're talking to, and how they're talking to their friends. If you don't, you might be shocked to find out what some of your kids are saying to some of these other kids. So anyway, I just want you to sit with that, let it, you know, marinate, and you know, maybe you'll think twice about letting your 10, 11, 12-year-old be on Snapchat. All right, I'll let you get back to your life for now. Thank you for hanging out with me. Until next time, take care of yourself, and I will see you on Friday for the Weekly Docket, where we recap the true crime headlines of the week. If you have any stories you want to suggest, send them my way. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you later. Bye.